Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. On our way to our conversation here, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. Or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner there. We are now joined here in studio by Leonard Pitts, Jr. Many of us know him as an award-winning columnist for Miami Herald and beyond. He has written four books, two nonfiction, two fiction. One of those columns, the other two novels.
Yeah, one was a book of columns. Then there was a book on African-American men and fatherhood. And then there's two novels.
And you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Dozens of people have written in on our Facebook pages. Not so many with questions saying, oh, I've got to read this book. I want to hear this conversation. So join us, 410-319-8888. So welcome. It's good to have you. Thank you for driving to Baltimore.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So where do we begin? There's so many places to begin. First of all, this book, Freeman. It starts out on the day slavery – I mean, on the day the Civil War ends, I misspoke earlier.
Yeah.
The day the Civil War ends.
Right.
So talk about the genesis for you in creating this book.
Well, I just was fascinated. I was doing some research for another project almost 30 years ago and came across these stories of these slaves, former slaves, who at the end of the Civil War began looking to reunite their families, began looking for their children, began looking for their mothers, and, you know, poignantly began looking for their husbands and wives. And it just amazed me that you have these stories of these people who walked literally across, counties and states and across the country looking for one another, most of the time never finding each other. And it struck me, one, that this is a very poignant and powerful, you know, confirmation of love and of the ties that bound those people. The other thing that struck me is we don't know this story.
We don't know this story.
No, exactly.
I know. And one of the things that struck me in reading this novel, mm-hmm. And is usually my one when I interview authors, I never quite finish the book before you come on because I don't want to let the end go by mistake.
Okay. So I won't talk beyond a certain point.
I'm that far from the end, and I will finish it this afternoon.
I won't mention that the butler did it. It was all a dream.
We don't want to know the butler did it.
Yeah,
but I get close enough to know what we're doing here.
right.
But one of the things that really struck me here was there's so many things in this book I want to kind of explore what your thoughts on, and our listeners can join us at 410-319-8888. Is that we also, before we get back to the part you just raised, we don't explore very much what the end of slavery meant, what the idea of freedom meant,
right.
The confusion around freedom, and the complexity of what it means to spend your entire life as a slave, born as a slave. That's all people knew was the whip. That's all people knew was saying yes or no, sir, and being a piece of property.
Ownership,
being owned.
Yes.
And then?
Suddenly you're free. Yeah, and the question becomes, what does freedom mean? We have a very simplistic view of African-American history. When I talk to people sometimes about this, I tell them our view is sort of that there was slavery and that was bad, and then Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and then...
and all was good.
And then black people disappeared until 1954, 55, when Rosa Parks decided to keep her seat. And there's sort of no in between. But as you allude to, there's sort of this rich and complex history in between those years, and it begins with this question of what does freedom mean? And that was something that struck every former slave when the chains came away. If I'm free, what does that mean? How do I define it? For some of them, it was a frightening thing. If you've been owned your entire life and you've been told that you're incapable of...
Our sound disappeared.
Hello? I hear myself now.
Okay, good, good.
If you've been owned your entire life and you've been told your entire life that you're incapable of anything beyond that, then suddenly to be set out and be free, you know, is almost like being a 10-year-old or a 5-year-old, you know, sent away from home. What do you do? So some people were very frightened. Some people were energized. Some people decided if I'm free, then I have to test this and see, you know, what the boundaries are. And that's when you have these people beginning to walk. One man, I love the story. There's a story of a former slave whose name I forget. He got up, and I believe he was in Tennessee or Arkansas, somewhere in that area, and he walked to Kansas just because he'd always heard about Kansas, and he wanted to see what it looked like.
Right, right.
Not even looking for anybody, just, oh, okay, this is Kansas, and then he walks back.
The walking.
Yeah.
I mean, your characters,
right.
Ben and Sam, these
right.
two men, Sam being the key, but Ben and
right.
Sam, walk one from Philadelphia to Mississippi, one from Washington, D.C.
to Tennessee.
To Tennessee.
Yeah.
The thousands of miles of walking
mm-hmm.
to find the woman they loved.
Right.
To find their wife.
Well, the women.
The women they loved. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The woman
it
each one
It wasn't
loved.
A love triangle. Yeah.
What woman each one loved.
Yes.
And the women who were their wives.
Right.
Trying to kind of see if they can find what happened one 7 years before, one 15 years before.
Right.
And that's even though this is fiction, that's a real story.
Yeah, those stories happen all the time. And even though, as you say, the novel is fiction, much of what is in the novel is historical fact that I took and repurposed for my own uses. For instance, there's a scene that you may recall where a woman comes into the courthouse and says, "Have you seen my baby?"
Oh, my God, that scene is so...
Yeah. Well, that actually happened.
Wrenching.
It was reported by
that
a white...
That actually happened.
It was reported by a white missionary in Virginia. That this woman came in and was asking, "Have you seen my baby?" And the woman, the missionary, is trying to figure out what she, you know, how would I know if I've seen your baby? And the woman says, "Oh, you surely know if you saw her. She's just the most beautiful baby." And it turns out the baby was sold from her 20 years before.
Ugh.
And that, you know, that actually happened. I said it, obviously, for my purposes elsewhere, but that actually happened.
That scene was just that you could feel this woman's pain,
right.
her loss. And they looked at her as if she was crazy, but
right.
and maybe she was driven crazy.
I think she'd been broken. You know that
a lot of people. That's part of it is being broken.
Yeah.
My producer's saying, "I'm gonna take a break. We'll come right back. We're talking to Leonard Pitts about his novel Freeman. Don't go away. Stay with us and join us at 410-319-8888. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with Leonard Pitts Jr., who drove up from Washington, D.C. to join us here in studio. He won the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for Commentary for his syndicated column, which you can see on his website and all over. We'll link to that. And he's here talking about his fourth book, a novel called Freeman, and it takes place after the Civil War. It takes place as the Civil War ended, the story of a number of people making journeys to the South for different reasons, after the end of the war.
Right.
We were talking about, during the break, a couple of things we were talking about, I think it was important. You mentioned, we were talking about how people went off to look for their families.
Right.
And you mentioned the kind of how these stories also came out of the Holocaust, which you can describe a bit. But
yeah, I hadn't thought about the parallel until one of my readers in a book signing mentioned it to me. But after the Holocaust, one of the first things that the surviving Jews did was to begin wandering Europe, looking, you know, to reconnect with their family members, going back to the village or going back to wherever it was they'd been stolen from to find out who survived. Where's my mom? Where's my children? Where's my wife? You know, there's a very definite parallel with what happened after slavery. The only difference, obviously, is that, you know, in the Holocaust, we're talking about post-1945, so there's slightly more sophistication in terms of the communications,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps you don't have to, you know, walk 1,000 miles to find that if someone is there. But the same process went on, people trying to relocate or trying to locate their loved ones.
And the other thing that we were talking about during break is that this is the difference here, though, is that for a number of differences, but the difference is that this part of our history is never spoken about in a creative way. It's never spoken about in terms of individual lives, human beings, human stories.
It's probably not spoken of much at all, but definitely not in terms of the human stories. I think people find them very painful. But I don't think that pain is a reason not to talk about something.
Right.
Sometimes pain is a reason is more of a spur to talk about something. But where slavery is concerned, I think so much of that is so close to us that a lot of us, black and white and otherwise, choose to sort of distance ourselves from it and not want to talk about it. One of my favorite comments that I get from people, and I see this all over message boards and readers who've talked to me about the book have said this also, is that it was so painful I had to stop reading it, but I had to go back,
right?
You know,
right.
which which is very high compliment to me. They couldn't read it, but they couldn't not read it.
Some of the book is very painful, but it's also... It's painful, but the way you describe people looking for the people they loved or going down to fight for human rights in the South after the war, it's also a story of integrity, of the human spirit, of people standing up, of not being cowed by what happened. That's part of it's important too. I think it's
a story of people's essential humanity, sort of, you know, reasserting itself under the most inhumane and brutal conditions. I think that's what it is.
Deeply inhumane, yeah. And you make a real effort to bring that out.
I tried to bring out the inhumanity of it, but I also tried to shade the characters who were engaged in this inhumanity, so you'd see where you didn't have to agree with them. I hope you don't agree with me. you didn't have to love them, but I wanted you to have some sense of what made them, what shaped them, and made them who and what they were.
No, right. I think even the way you painted the racist white.
Are we talking Marsh Jim or are we talking the Wheaton family?
More the Wheaton family than Marsh Jim. There's not a lot redeemable in Marsh Jim so far. That
I like Marsh Jim. He was one of my favorite characters to write.
And why was he one of your? And we're talking about a character who was the owner of the wife of Sam, who he is looking for.
Right.
And he's a pretty brutal character when it comes to how he treated slaves. And
but he loved his son.
But he loved his. Was that? That's it. Yes.
He loved his son. And so you can see how he became what he is. He loved his son. And he grew up in a society which told him that no matter how, you know, unlettered and brutish and ignorant he was, because he was white and his slave, who's actually better educated than him, was black and was a woman, she is an inferior form of humanity. So you don't like him, you don't agree with him, but you understand what made him who he is, and you can see, you know, how his humanity became twisted. I even in characters like that, it was important to me to kind of try to locate the humanity. As gnarled and twisted and broken as it was, to really try to locate that.
Was part of that for you? Now, maybe this is, I mean, I'm I don't want to project in what you were doing.
But right.
thinking was that one of the things I look at read characters like Marsh Jim was that Ethelbert Miller, who's a poet, wrote this piece one day about wrestling with people who commit heinous crimes, whether they're slavers or whether they're ran concentration camps or whatever, are they human beings as well? And I wrote back saying, they are. They take out the garbage. They love their wives. They kiss their children goodnight. Then they go off to beat slaves or put people in gas chambers.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought of.
What I was trying to get at. I think I said a moment ago that our view of history tends to be very simplistic, and one of the things that we tend to do in that simplistic view is to paint, you know, all our slaves and all, for that matter, all of our American Indians are these noble, square-jawed, you know, flawless, you know, bland creatures, and all of our bad guys, all of our slave owners, and all of our, you know, soldiers who committed genocide against the natives are the Native Americans are these, you know, cruel, evil, you know, no redeeming, and humanity is much more complicated and much more fascinating than that.
This piece, because it hit me, just talking about Sam. I'm just read a little piece, and then I'll let you read. I want you to read the piece you were going to read, and I'll read pieces from the book that kind of grabbed me or can you to read.
Sure.
It struck Sam that the war had left slaves a nation of mad women and men, rootless, homeless, wandering about, looking for wives, looking for children, trying to get back that which could never be retrieved, but put back what once was, and never mind that you knew, though you would never admit to yourself, that this was not possible. This was not possible.
Right.
That journey of people trying to find the ones they loved.
Yeah. It sort of, you know, parallels the larger African-American, you know, story, because the first break, obviously, is from Africa to here, which we were talking about during the break. You know, you can never know. If you're an African-American, you can never quite know where you came from unless, you know, like Alex Haley, you do a ton of work.
Right.
And you're incredibly lucky also, but otherwise you're never going to quite know where you came from. And then you have this further break that happened here in slavery. So, for a lot of us, history is two or three generations old.
Could you want to read the piece that that we were talking about?
Sure. You tell me when to stop, because it's... It goes a fair way. This is when Sam is walking along the bridge, and he's just dismissed Ben. Ben has wanted to suggested they walk together, and he's just dismissed Ben because Ben is a rough-hewn and not quite literate person. Sam is very literate and very conscious of his and very proud of his being literate. At length, he came to a bridge spanning the Potomac River. The river was broad and placid here, lapping peacefully at the pilings below. Two Union soldiers watched him approach. "What is your business?" one challenged when he stood before them. "Nothing," said Sam, surprised. "I am just walking." "What's your name?" Sam stiffened. His head came up. "My name is Sam," he said. "That's all? Sam?" The soldier, a boy, really, shaggy, blonde hair, chin whiskers still wispy, was spoiling for a fight. Sam considered his responses carefully. He thought of saying he was Sam Wilson, after the man who had owned him last, but something in him fumed against the thought. He had a self, and it was one he wholly possessed, one that was not tied to a white man who had once considered him his property. Otherwise, what was the purpose of his escape to freedom? What was the purpose of these last 4 years of slaughter and privation? What was the purpose of the president's murder? He was an individual, not a nameless, interchangeable part of some infernal white man's machine. So he looked the white boy quite deliberately in the eye. "Free man," he said. He pronounced the syllables separately, distinctly, stopping between them, making them a statement in themselves. "My name is Sam Free Man." The boy's eyes widened, then hardened. The next thing Sam knew, he was lying on the wooden planks of the bridge, his hand to his bloodied mouth, his eyes flashing light that was not there. Instinctively, Sam reached behind to push himself back up. He stopped when he saw the pistol leveled at him, the boy's hand so tight on the trigger that in some part of his mind, Sam marveled that he was not already dead.
Sure. And I want to get to the point where, yeah. What's his name? Ben intervenes. There's a little piece where Ben intervenes there that was really telling.
I'll go a little further then. Sam marveled that he was not already dead. "Are you sassing me, nigger?" From somewhere beyond the pistol that filled his vision, the white boy's voice came to him, high and shaky, as if the boy could not get in, could not suck in enough breath. "You asked who I was, sir," he said, and was pleased to hear that his voice was quiet and reasonable and did not shake. "You asked my cognomen. You asked my appellation." Big words the boy soldier would not know. "I asked your name," the boy thundered, and Sam was distantly gratified by this unwitting confirmation of ignorance. "And I gave it to you," he said. "My name is Sam Freeman." He spoke evenly. He did not separate the syllables this time. "Jakey, what are you doing?" The second soldier, a voice from far away attempting to soothe his friend. "Put the gun down." "Did you hear him?" Jakey's voice had risen yet higher in indignation. "That's what it's going to be like from now on, don't you know? You mark my words, niggers sassing white men, putting on airs." "Mars?" A new voice had entered. Sam risked turning ever so slightly to find the source. His gaze fell upon a dark-skinned Negro who approached cautiously, palms up. It was Ben. He was smiling. His smile was blazing, teeth dazzling white, and every last one on display. The gun swiveled toward him, returned to Sam. "Who are you? What the hell do you want?" Impossibly, the smile broadened. "You ain't want to shoot old Shine, sir. Shine, that's what they calls me, and I was just trying to explain this boy here ain't meant no harm. Nah, sir, see, family he used to belong to, they's called the Freemans, but they's a white family, you see, live down near Nolens. He just figured with the fighting over, he'd go down there and see if they got any work for him, 'cause he missed the old place, you see, miss his white folks. Plumb sorry he ever run off, that's what he told me." "Is that true?" the boy soldier demanded of Sam. "'Course it's true," said Ben. He was next to Sam now, had his hands under Sam's armpits, and was pulling him to his feet. He never stopped talking, never stopped smiling at the boy soldier. "We was traveling together, in fact, but Sammy here, he walked so fast, he's so impatient to be there, he run off and left me. Ain't that right, Sammy?" He smiled up expectantly. It took Sam a moment. Yes, he finally managed. Yes, that is right. Shine clapped him on the back hard enough to jar his bones. "See, there you go. This weren't nothing more than a little misunderstanding is all." The soldier Jakey regarded them dubiously, and for a moment Sam was sure the lie had not worked. Then the second soldier took over and waved them through. "Go on, get out of here." "Yes, sir," said Shine promptly. "Thank you, sir." And clasping Sam's neck as if he were a troublesome child, he steered him past the guard post. He let his hand fall away a moment later, but the two men did not speak. They walked in silence for long minutes as the bridge fell further behind them. Finally, Sam said, I want to thank you for what you did. Ben snorted. You mean you couldn't get yourself out of it with your proper English and talking like you got marbles in your mouth? Nah, I expect you couldn't. Like to got yourself killed back there, Mr. Free Man.
So that piece, all of it, I think that the some of what you explore here, too, are the roots of what people see in America today.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the...
It's funny you should say that because, one of the things about writing, when you're writing a historical novel, you're sort of trapped as the narrator in that time period. You can't project forward
and
draw the line for readers and say this is how this connects to such and such. But I was really hoping that readers themselves, as you just did, I was hoping readers would make the leap because so much of what you see in terms of the attitudes and the behaviors in this book, which is set in 1865, you can project forward and see in America and particularly in the South in the 1950s and in some ways traces of it even still today.
And also that you touch on throughout the book the complexities of black and what it means to be black in the 19th century, what it means to be white in the 19th century, what it means to be maybe neither one or a little bit of both in the 19th century, and what it means if you are so sucked into the slavery system even as a black man, you can be cruel to your own. I think you are working for the as a slaver as opposed to being somebody who wants to free his brethren. I mean, the complexity of it all is what you tried to touch as well.
That's what I was – again, I think that – I keep repeating this, but I think that
we
tend to be very simplistic
in
our discussion and understanding of race and our discussion and understanding of racial history. And if you really go back and look at what the people said – and what they did and who they were in that era, the actual people, what you find is a level of complexity that just that you never find in our recounting. One story that I love is the story of this slave couple. The Union Army came through, I believe it was Sherman's troops, and they freed the slaves and they went following Sherman's troops, but they were concerned about Mother Hulsey who had owned them, tend to forget there was affection sometimes between the owners and the owned. And it's a fascinating story because they got to the Union camp and the Army made camp that night, but this couple could not stop worrying about Mother Hulsey, who was left on the old place all alone. So they ask permission and they go back that night and they chop wood and do laundry for Mother Hulsey just to set her up a little bit better, and then they head back to the Union camp. I mean, those kinds of complexities and shadings of feelings often, don't make it into our comprehension of what happened then.
And they don't negate the brutality.
No, not at all.
Of white people towards black folks in the 19th century.
No.
Whether it was this not as a, well, sometimes overt, northern brutality, but clearly the southern brutality.
Right. It doesn't negate it. What I tried to do was to shade it and help people to understand where it came from.
And there's other characters. Let's talk a bit about some of the other characters. If you listen to Prudence.
Prudence Cafferty Kent.
And Bonnie.
Yes, uh-huh. Prudence is a wealthy white war widow from Boston who is stubborn and impulsive and very much a woman of the 21st century, even though she's living in the 19th. She is friends. She's actually, for all intents and purposes, sisters with Bonnie. Bonnie is a black woman of about the same age, 26, who was raised with Prudence. Prudence's father is an abolitionist, and he's had a tradition of going down south once a year to buy a slave and set that slave free. And Bonnie is the first slave that he set free, and she and Prudence were raised together. And they go down to this town in Mississippi to start a school in accordance with Prudence's father's dying wish. And Prudence, being the headstrong and impulsive person that she is, can't quite get it through her head that going down to Mississippi literally the week after the war has ended and saying, I'm starting a school for your former slaves. Oh, and by the way, this black woman is my sister, is not the most, not in terms of self-preservation, it's not the best thing to do. But Prudence has because she's stubborn and hard-headed, really has difficulty comprehending that.
And the anger and viciousness of former Confederates,
right,
whether they be slave owners or not, was clearly painted, but you also painted it as in some sense, that anger coming out of a wound.
Yeah, for the you know, they thought they had a country, you know, which is something that I, you know, from the vantage point of history, vehemently disagree with.
Yeah, right.
But at the same point, I understand, you know, where they were coming from. They felt that they had a country. Their country, such as it was stillborn. Abraham Lincoln and the Union Army saw to that. And I think that what happened when what that caused was it opened a wound in them that in a lot of ways really has never healed. You still get that in the American South. That's why you still see the flag flying. I mean, from a geopolitical point of view, flying at you know,
stars and bars.
Yeah, flying the stars and bars is like, I don't know, flying a Cubs banner, you know, in sports or something. It's like you're celebrating loss. You're celebrating the apologies to any Cubs fans, but you're celebrating, you know, historical losing. And not only did they lose, but morally they deserve to lose. But I think that for a lot of people in the South then and now, you can't get past that sense of loss, that sense of we had something or we tried to have something and it was taken from us.
But I couldn't get – the way I look at things sometimes, I couldn't help but think as I was reading the novel that these were also the kind of mass psychosocial roots of who we are
yes.
in the 21st century.
Yes. Again, I was trying to sort of project that forward. But, yeah, it is the roots of who we are.
Because it's like if you write a story about an individual and they've been beaten by their mother and father, or their father was an alcoholic, yeah. and how that created who they are, or their father was a prisoner, whatever that might be, socially and as human beings, culturally, that happens to us as well.
Yeah, and it carries forward,
with, right?
You know, the whole sense of white entitlement that you see from some of the characters in the book, particularly. You know, not just the wealthy characters, but even some of the poorer characters. A.J. Socrates, for instance, who's a guy who's scraping by in ownership of a store. But you see some of that same sense when you talk to people about race, even to this very day.
There's the other character to talk about here for a moment is I want people to get a sense of all the people you kind of brought to the fore. We talked is Tilda,
yeah,
the wife of Sam, who he is searching for,
right.
I mean, that character just, she clearly had inner strength on some level, deep inner strength, but she just breaks your heart.
Yeah, I've heard so many people say that Tilda frustrates them a lot. Tilda,
that's frustrating because I understood what she was going through. You painted it so clearly what was happening to her psyche.
Yeah, Tilda, like Sam, had been initially owned. They'd been owned together by a woman who was eccentric by slave owner standards and who didn't physically mistreat her slaves and didn't separate families and even allowed them to learn to read. But she goes from this to being sold to Marsh Jim. And Marsh Jim is the exact opposite of that. Marsh Jim rapes his female slaves. He brutalizes. He hits for no apparent reason. I mean, he's a punch in the face kind of guy. And what's happened after 4 years of this is that Tilda has sort of closed up. She has been reduced from all that spark and sparkle and sort of sass that Sam remembers to this person who's just trying to survive. And even when she's told that she's free, even when supposedly freedom has come, she can't make herself take it because she is in fear. Not only just is she in fear of Marsh Jim, but internally, you know, she's also enslaved because, as you noticed, probably from having read the book, she has several very good opportunities to get away from Marsh Jim.
And doesn't do it. The piece is where she's about, when she knows she can leave, and she's stuck there, and she's about to step off the step.
Mm-hmm.
But she can't make the step.
Right.
Even though she knows she can do it.
Right.
That what can be beaten out of a human being, not... could happen to anybody.
Yeah, it's about the psychological brutalization. It's about there's a book called Slaves Without Masters, and at that point that's kind of what she is. The whole, you know, she knows intellectually that she can now be free, but she can't really get past her fear. And again, what does freedom mean? If I leave this man now, I am a homeless, you know, moneyless, rootless woman wandering the defeated South. If I leave him, where do I go and what do I do?
And you really, I mean, I think what's also important about this book is, and I think it's important for people to read books like this, is because of the way you also create these individual characters, each with their own depth and story. Even characters who aren't the major figures in the story but appear in the story.
Right.
Especially, say, in the town where Prudence and Bonnie go to start this school for people in Mississippi. The characters you bring, especially in the, well, both black and white community, but
right.
the characters of the freed slaves and the depth of their desire to learn to read, to just what they want, what freedom means to them. That was such an important piece of the story.
Well,
and the reaction by the white folks.
Exactly. That's also from the record, and that's also one of the ways in which they decided to define freedom. If I'm free, then I can be educated. If only to read the Bible. You know, for a lot of slaves, it was just educate me enough that I can sign my name before I die, or just educate me enough that I can read my favorite passage from the Bible before I die. There are, you know, pictures of these just ancient, you know, former slaves bent over desks studying, you know, these books in the Reconstruction era that'll just break your heart. These old people who are, you know, have lived, you know, 70, 80, 90 years without knowing how to read. Before I die, I want to at least have this much of freedom in my life.
Because old people came to the evening schools, the young people came, and the kids desperately wanted to learn, and they were there during the day schools.
Yeah.
But the brutality of kind of white people's response to all that.
Because they're threatened. Yeah. My self-image has come from the fact that whatever I am, at least I'm better than you. And now all of a sudden, if you are doing things that challenge my assumptions about you, then it challenges my assumption about myself, and you got to die.
And part of that, there's a little piece in here about Prudence.
Right.
When she's in the church for the first time in her life, the only white woman in a sea of black faces that is not on her territory but theirs, and you write, "This is the first time in her life the realization came as something of a shock. The first time in her life she had been alone with a mass of colored people in one of their places, where she was only a guest and controlled nothing. Prudence looked back into a sea of dark eyes, dark hair, dark skin, and felt heat rising in her cheeks. Though he had only spoken crudely, Bo Wheaton," who was this racist guy, "had spoken truthfully in a way. She had cast her lot with them. She had not understood until this very moment exactly what that meant."
Yeah, yeah. That's a very apt description, I guess. At least I hope of you know what Prudence felt, and also I think a dynamic that we don't think of very much, even in our modern times. I remember reading once about everybody says they want a diverse neighborhood. but there was a study that was done where for African Americans that means sort of half and half. But for white Americans, after it gets to be 25% black,
time to go,
which I found very interesting.
It's true. I mean, that's why this book is so full of roots of stuff, but it's done in such a creative way. There's a passage I'm here I can't find, which was a passage where you really describe how the confusion over freedom. But I think that's part of the part of the beauty of this book is that it brings out pieces that we never think about when it comes to the post-slavery America. I just don't know what else to say other than that. Are you looking for a short piece to share? We have about 2 minutes left. Go ahead.
No, actually, I was trying to look for the date that I'm going to be at the library because I wanted to make sure that we mentioned that.
That's not North. We got to do that right now, Bobby. We need that date right away. It's not on the sheet. So we can make sure the world knows about this.
Here we go. Yeah, the 4th of June at Enoch Pratt.
At 7 p.m.
6:30, I believe.
6:30.
That's what I have, yeah.
4th of June, 6:30.
Yeah.
We will be there. You should be there. Leonard Pitts will be reading from his book, Freeman, June the 4th, 6:30 at the Central Branch downtown. It'll be a book signing. He'll be talking about this book, reading from the book. And we will be promoting this between now and then as well to make sure that you all arrive and meet Leonard Pitts Jr., the novel again, Freeman. This is his 4th book, and you can also go to, which we'll be connecting to, his webpage, and we'll be connecting that on our website to see his work and everything else he's done and read his latest columns to boot.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being in the studio.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've had a good time.
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
On our way out of here, I'm going to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Lila Warshaw. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new interviews, but more importantly, find out information about our guests, please visit us at steinershow.org. You can listen to our podcast, download our podcast on iTunes. Reminding you, Monday, join us. We will have two very special documentaries we produced around the Vietnam War with veterans that will be taking place here from 9 to 11 Monday morning on Memorial Day. I hope you all have a lovely Memorial Day weekend. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Stay tuned now. Michelle Martin's coming up with Tell Me More. Don't go away.